He was not riding a great maker palanquin now, the tinkle of water rings among the passengers a rhythm for their passage songs. No, he was here in the cell of Jacques Arutu, embarked on that most dangerous of all journeys, away from and back to the Al Asuna Wal Jamas, from the real world of the senses and back to that world. What was she doing there with the water rings tinkling in her hair? Oh, yes, she was mixing more of the brew which they thought held him captive, food laced with spice essence to keep him half in and half out of the real universe until either he died or his grandmother's plan succeeded. And every time he thought he'd won, they sent him back. The Lady Jessica was right, of course, that old witch. But what a thing to do. The total recall of all those lives within him was of no use at all until he could organize the data and remember it at will. Those lives had been the raw stuff of anarchy. One or all of them could have overwhelmed him. The spice and its peculiar setting here in Jacques Arutu had been a desperate gamble. Now Gurney waits for the sign, and I refuse to give it to him. How long will his patience last? He stared out at Sabiha. She'd thrown her hood back and revealed the tribal tattoos at her temples. Leto did not recognize the tattoos at first, then remembered where he was. Yes, Jacques Arutu still lived. Leto did not know whether to be thankful toward his grandmother or hate her. She wanted him to have conscious-level instincts, but instincts were only racial memories of how to handle crises. His direct memories of those other lives told him far more than that. He had it all organized now, and could see the peril of revealing himself to Gurney. No way of keeping the revelation from Namri, and Namri was another problem. Sabiha entered the cell with a bowl in her hands. He admired the way the light from outside made rainbow circles at the edges of her hair. Gently she raised his head and began feeding him from the bowl. It was only then he realized how weak he was. He allowed her to feed him while his mind went roving, recalling the session with Gurney and Namri. They believed him. Namri more than Gurney, but even Gurney could not deny what his senses had already reported to him about the planet. Sabiha wiped his mouth with a hem of her robe. Ah, Sabiha, he thought, recalling that other vision which filled his heart with pain. Many nights have I dreamed beside the open water, hearing the winds pass overhead. Many nights my flesh lay beside the snake's den, and I dreamed of Sabiha in the summer heat. I saw her storing spice bread baked on red-hot sheets of plasteel. I saw the clear water in the Khanat, gentle and shining, but a storm wind ran through my heart. She sips coffee and eats. Her teeth shine in the shadows. I see her braiding my water rings into her hair. The amber fragrance of her bosom strikes through to my innermost senses. She torments me and oppresses me by her very existence. The pressure of his multi-memories exploded the time-frozen englobement which he had tried to resist. He felt twining bodies, the sounds of sex, rhythms laced in every sensory impression, lips, breathing, moist breaths, tongues. Somewhere in his vision there were helix shapes, coal-colored, and he felt the beat of those shapes as they turned within him. A voice pleaded in his skull, "Please, please, please, please." There was an adult beef swelling in his loins, and he felt his mouth open, holding, clinging to the girder shape of ecstasy. Then a sigh, a lingering ground-swelling sweetness, a collapse. Oh, how sweet to let that come into existence! Sabiha, he whispered. Oh, my Sabiha! When her charge had clearly gone deeply into the trance after his food, Sabiha took the bowl and left, pausing at the doorway to speak to Namri. He called my name again.
Go back and stay with him, Namri said. I must find Halleck and discuss this with him.
Sabiha deposited the bowl beside the doorway and returned to the cell. She sat on the edge of the cot, staring at Leto's shadowed face. Presently he opened his eyes and put a hand out, touching her cheek. He began to talk to her then, telling her about the vision in which she had lived. She covered his hand with her own as he spoke. How sweet he was! How very sweet! She sank onto the cot, cushioned by his hand, unconscious before he pulled that hand away. Leto sat up, feeling the depths of his weakness. The spice and its visions had drained him. He searched through his cells for every spare spark of energy, climbed from the cot without disturbing Sabiha. He had to go, but he knew he'd not get far. Slowly he sealed his stillsuit, drew the robe around him, slipped through the passage to the outer shaft. There were a few people about, busy at their own affairs. They knew him, but he was not their responsibility. Namri and Halleck would know what he was doing. Sabiha could not be far away. He found the kind of side passage he needed, and walked boldly down it. Behind him, Sabiha slept peacefully until Halleck roused her. She sat up, rubbed her eyes, saw the empty cot, saw her uncle standing behind Halleck, the anger on their faces. Namri answered the expression on her face.
"Yes, he's gone."
"How could you let him escape?" Halleck raged. "How is this possible?"
"He was seen going toward the lower exit," Namri said, his voice oddly calm.
Sabiha cowered in front of them, remembering.
"How?"
Halleck demanded.
"I don't know. I don't know."
"It's night and he's weak," Namri said. "He won't get far."
Halleck whirled on him.
"You want the boy to die?"
"It wouldn't displease me."
Again Halleck confronted Sabiha.
"Tell me what happened."
"He touched my cheek. He kept talking about his vision, us together."
She looked down at the empty cot.
"He made me sleep. He put some magic on me."
Halleck glanced at Namri.
"Could he be hiding inside somewhere?"
"Nowhere inside. He'd be found, seen. He was headed for the exit. He's out there."
"Magic," Sabiha muttered.
"No magic," Namri said. "He hypnotized her. Almost did it to me, you remember? Said I was his friend."
"He's very weak," Halleck said.
"Only in his body," Namri said. "He won't go far, though. I disabled the heel pumps of his stillsuit. He'll die with no water if we don't find him."
Halleck almost turned and struck Namri, but held himself in rigid control. Jessica had warned him that Namri might have to kill the lad. Gods below, what a pass they'd come to. Atreides against Atreides. He said,
"Is it possible he just wandered away in the spice trance?" "What difference does it make?" Namri asked. "If he escapes us, he must die."
"We'll start searching at first light," Halleck said. "Did he take a Fremkit?"
"There's always a few beside the door seal," Namri said. "He'd have been a fool not to take one. Somehow he has never struck me as a fool."
"Then send a message to our friends," Halleck said. "Tell them what's happened."
"No messages this night," Namri said. "There is a storm coming. The tribes have been tracking it for 3 days now. It'll be here by midnight. Already communications blanked out. The satellites signed off this sector 2 hours ago."
A deep sigh shook Halleck. The boy would die out there for sure if the sandblast storm caught him. It would eat the flesh from his bones and sliver the bones to fragments. The contrived false death would become real. He slapped a fist into an open palm. The storm could trap them in the siege. They couldn't even mount a search. And storm static had already isolated the siege.
"Distrans," he said,
thinking they might imprint a message onto a bat's voice and dispatch it with the alarm. Namri shook his head.
"Bats won't fly in a storm. Come on, man. They're more sensitive than we are. They'll cower in the cliffs until it's past. Best to wait for the satellites to pick us up again. Then we can try to find his remains."
"Not if he took a Fremkit and hid in the sand," Sabiha said.
Cursing under his breath, Halleck whirled away from them, strode out into the siege.
Peace demands solutions, but we never reach living solutions. We only work toward them. A fixed solution is, by definition, a dead solution. The trouble with peace is that it tends to punish mistakes instead of rewarding brilliance.
The Words of My Father, an account of Muad'Dib reconstructed by Hark al-Adda.
"She's training him? She's training Faradin?"
Alia glared at Duncan Idaho with a deliberate mix of anger and incredulity. The Guild Highliner had swung into orbit around Arrakis at noon local. An hour later, the lighter had put Idaho down at Arrakeen, unannounced, but all casual and open. Within minutes, a thopter had deposited him atop the keep. Warned of his impending arrival, Alia had greeted him there, coldly formal before her guards, but now they stood in her quarters beneath the north rim. He had just delivered his report, truthfully, precisely, emphasizing each datum in Mentat fashion.
"She has taken leave of her senses," Alia said.
He treated the statement as a Mentat problem.
"All the indicators are that she remains well-balanced, sane. I should say her sanity index was..." "Stop that," Alia snapped. "What can she be thinking of?"
Idaho, who knew that his own emotional balance depended now upon retreat into Mentat coldness, said,
"I compute she is thinking of her granddaughter's betrothal."
His features remained carefully bland, a mask for the raging grief which threatened to engulf him. There was no Alia here. Alia was dead. For a time he'd maintained a myth Alia before his senses, someone he'd manufactured out of his own needs, but a Mentat could carry on such self-deception for only a limited time. This creature in human guise was possessed. A demon psyche drove her. His steely eyes, with their myriad facets available at will, reproduced upon his vision centers a multiplicity of myth Alias. but when he combined them into a single image, no Alia remained. Her features moved to other demands. She was a shell within which outrages had been committed.
"Where's Ghanima?"
he asked. She waved the question aside.
"I've sent her with Irulan to stay in Stilgar's keeping." "Neutral territory," he thought. "There's been another negotiation with rebellious tribes. She's losing ground and doesn't know it. Or does she? Is there another reason? Has Stilgar gone over to her?"
"The betrothal," Alia mused. "What are conditions in the Carino house?"
"Seleucia swarms with Utrine relatives, all working upon Faradin, hoping for a share in his return to power."
"And she's training him in the Bene Gesserit.
Is it not fitting for Ghanima's husband?"
Alia smiled to herself, thinking of Ghanima's adamant rage. Let Faradin be trained. Jessica was training a corpse. It would all work out.
"I must consider this at length," she said. "You're very quiet, Duncan."
"I await your questions."
"I see. You know, I was very angry with you, taking her to Faradin."
"You commanded me to make it real."
"I was forced to put out the report that you'd both been taken captive," she said.
"I obeyed your orders."
"You're so literal at times, Duncan. You almost frighten me. But if you hadn't, well..."
"The Lady Jessica's out of harm's way," he said. "And for Ghanima's sake, we should be grateful, that exceedingly grateful," she agreed. And she thought,
"He's no longer trustworthy. He has that damnable Atreides loyalty. I must make an excuse to send him away, and have him eliminated. An accident, of course."
She touched his cheek. Idaho forced himself to respond to the caress, taking her hand and kissing it.
"Duncan, Duncan, how sad it is," she said. "But I cannot keep you here with me. Too much is happening, and I've so few I can completely trust."
He released her hand, waited.
"I was forced to send Ghanima to Tabor," she said. "Things are in deep unrest here. Raiders from the Broken Lands breached the Khanats at Kaga Basin and spilled all of their waters into the sands. Arakeen was on short rations. The basin's alive with sand trout yet, reaping the water harvest. They're being dealt with, of course, but were spread very thin."
He'd already noted how few Amazons of Alia's guard were to be seen in the keep, and he thought, "The Maquis of the Inner Desert will keep on probing her defenses. Doesn't she know that?"
"Tabor is still neutral territory," she said. "Negotiations are continuing there right now. Javid's there with a delegation from the priesthood. But I'd like you at Tabor to watch them, especially Irulan."
"She is Carino," he agreed.
But he saw in her eyes that she was rejecting him. How transparent this Alia creature had become. She waved a hand.
"Go now, Duncan, before I soften and keep you here beside me. I've missed you so."
"And I've missed you,"
he said, allowing all of his grief to flow into his voice. She stared at him, startled by the sadness. Then,
"For my sake, Duncan."
And she thought,
"Too bad, Duncan."
She said,
"Zia will take you to Tabor. We'll need the Thopter back here."
Her pet Amazon, he thought. I must be careful of that one. I understand, he said, once more taking her hand and kissing it. He stared at the dear flesh which once had been his Alia's. He could not bring himself to look at her face as he left. Someone else stared back at him from her eyes. As he mounted to the keep's roof pad, Idaho probed a growing sense of unanswered questions. The meeting with Alia had been extremely trying for the mentat part of him which kept reading data signs. He waited beside the Thopter with one of the keep's Amazons, staring grimly southward. Imagination took his gaze beyond the shield wall to Siege Tabor.
"Why does Zia take me to Tabor? Returning a Thopter is a menial task. What is the delay? Is Zia getting special instructions?"
Idaho glanced at the watchful guard, mounted to the pilot's position in the Thopter. He leaned out, said,
"Tell Alia I'll send the Thopter back immediately with one of Stilgar's men."
Before the guard could protest, he closed the door and started the Thopter. He could see her standing there indecisively. Who could question Alia's consort? He had the Thopter airborne before she could make up her mind what to do. Now, alone in the Thopter, he allowed his grief to spend itself in great, racking sobs. Alia was gone. They had parted forever. Tears flowed from his Tlaelaxu eyes, and he whispered,